Hi, it's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Richard Lawson. We're here to discuss the sixth episode and the penultimate episode of the HBO series The White Lotus called Abductions, a very dangerous sounding title for an episode that is indeed full of danger.
Yeah, and later I'll talk to Aubrey Plaza, whose character Harper has entered a whole new level in her unhappy marriage this week.
It's not just a bad vacation, you know, it's a bad time in their marriage, and they just happen to be going to the most beautiful place on a beautiful vacation, but they're just not in a good place.
And of course, there is the ongoing and ever more pertinent question of who winds up dead at the end of the show. It's not just going to be one person, we don't think.
Yeah.
And we only have one more week left to speculate, which means, Chris, you and I today, this episode, have to make final predictions.
Yeah, we got to lock them in.
And just to remind you guys that there is something at stake here for Chris and I, at least, that the person who gets closest or dead on in predicting who's dead has to buy the other. Well, is bought an Aperol Spritz by the other. Yes.
If either of us are dead on, I'll buy two Aperol Spritzes.
Okay.
How about that?
We're just going to get drunk in the studio, basically. That's what's going to happen. So, Chris, there's something I've been wanting to say to you since we started recording this podcast.
Okay, I'm nervous.
I love your big pupils.
Wow, you started that. I didn't know where we were going, but wow. That's because I do a lot of cocaine every time right before coming into the pod, just like Tanya did this episode.
She sure did. I thought that was a great Tanya-esque line because it's like, I guess that's a compliment.
It's more of like an observation, but like delivered as sort of a compliment. I will say, and this is maybe a bad take, that party looked fun as hell. I would love to go to that party.
I know. It did shamefully look sort of fun. And to the extent that I'm like, if I saw my supposedly rich benefactor and his nephew having sex at the house where I'm staying, I probably would have left. But then again. Promise of the hottest guy in Sicily and a fun party and some party drugs.
And like, they did definitely deliver on that, Niccolo. we did see that.
Look, Mike White knows what he's doing.
He knows what he's doing, and he does it well. But to that, I think what happened with Jennifer Coolidge and Tanya this episode, it's so much about the art of seduction. She got so seduced by the lifestyle and the beauty and the party favors and the drugs and the hung Italian man that she sort of...
With a cocaine bag.
With a bag of cocaine and a gun.
Yep. That she liked.
That she sort of forgot about the experience she had the night before seeing Quentin and Jack going to town on each other.
Right. I guess the question is, like, in her mind, maybe the math, as much as Tanya does math, is like, what does it really matter?
like what she can do.
Okay, they lied about being uncle and nephew. They're actually, maybe Jack is kind of a rent boy and he's embarrassed to say that. And so, whatever.
But shouldn't she feel like she's in some danger?
Well, yeah,
to some degree.
We know that because the music is ominous and the cinematography gets more ominous. But I don't know. I think Tanya is just choosing to believe in the magical thinking and just kind of be like, you know what? Okay, that was weird. Because Tanya also sees something major that I would be like run screening from the house, which is that Greg in that photo?
That's exactly. Well, that's where I'm like, Tanya, your alarm bells, your siren bells should be ring-ding-a-ling because that is your husband wearing a cowboy hat next to Quentin.
Right.
And you've just heard the Brokeback Mountain monologue about how Quentin was in love with this one man, this one cowboy. And that cowboy definitely seems to be Greg.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We got a lot of listener theories about
that. We got a lot of people emailed stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, and we heard from a variety of people, from Anna, from Ashley, some other people. I'm sorry, I'm not naming all your names.
Yes, Madeline, like, Allie, Michael, lots of you.
And you guys were all way ahead of that. I genuinely didn't think that was going to be a connection. You know, this is clearly, well, we think who Greg was talking to on the phone episodes ago in episode two. I think part of it, though, and I will defend ourselves a little bit about why we kind of didn't go down that, like, almost lost level of connected conspiracy, is that I didn't really think or maybe want that to be what the show is. This kind of intricate mystery. Because the first season was a mystery about, like, who's dead?
Yeah.
But past that, it wasn't really about secret connections and deceptions and all that stuff, as far as I remember.
Totally.
But, you know, now that it's come, and actually it turns out that there are sort of layers to this and sort of hidden meanings all the way back to episode two or earlier even. I don't mind it. I mean, I'm curious to see where it goes.
I don't mind it. I was scrolling through TikTok as I'm wont to do and texting with friends, and they were like, Quentin and Greg are definitely in cahoots and whatnot. And initially my response was like, oh, like, that's a little cheap. Like, that's, like, you know, sort of easy in a way. But honestly, after seeing this episode, I think a really great thing about the penultimate episode is that we didn't get that many answers. And even though we're saying that Quentin and Greg are definitely in cahoots, we saw that photo. I got to be honest, the first time I saw that photo, I had to rewind. I was like, is that Greg? I sort of forget what Greg looks like. I don't even know what young Greg looks like.
Right.
But I think it's safe to assume, given Jennifer Coolidge's reaction and the ominous music and the Wyoming story, that that's probably Greg in that photo. I don't think it's... I don't think it's cheap. I think it actually activates Tanya in a really interesting way. And now I want to, like, go back and watch some of the scenes with her and Greg and sort of reappraise some of Jennifer Coolidge's performance, which, like, we've both been a fan of, but we were sort of like, what does she do? Like, it's, you know, our Coolidge meter was sort of like, okay, she's here for a fun time, not really purposefully. And now it's like, oh, wait, she's the reason for the season. Tanya's what we're doing here.
Yeah, and look, maybe she's going to deal with the Greg situation after she has a role in the hay with the hot Italian guy. So, you know, and I can't blame her for that.
I can't blame her for that. I will say, speaking of Portia and Tanya and potential murders, I'm real nervous for our girl Portia right now. And I will say, Tanya did try to warn her, or, you know, about Jack.
In a poignant scene. I mean, kind of mean.
Oh, totally.
What did she call her? Empty or something?
Yes.
Portia, when I see you, I see a younger version of me. You know, when I was a little girl, my mother used to dress me up like a little doll. And I was always a little doll, waiting for someone to play with me. You know, when you're empty inside and you have no direction, you'll end up in some crazy places, right? But you'll still be lost.
What are you trying to say? Like,
get your shit together, Portia.
Look, Jack has clearly been assigned to distract her.
Yes.
Right?
Abduct her, maybe, even, if we're going with the title of the...
Yeah, well, if he's doing that, he's a bad abductor because he got too drunk and passed out.
Yeah, but she is
and also
alone.
Blabbed.
Yeah, and blabbed, but she is literally alone in a hotel room with Jack, with her bags.
Right.
Apparently.
And I was thinking, okay, so she leaves him sleeping in the hotel room. Does she even know the address of that villa? Like, does she even know how to go back there?
Now, I was like, girl, like, call a cab. I don't know, but like, where? Yeah, there's no way that she knows how
she'd
to get back.
She'd just be like, villa, please?
the Palazzo, please?
Yeah. But it is interesting that Tanya... who's like, okay, you're me when I'm younger, but I'm trying to warn you off of that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe something of that works, because we see Portia, like, on this date or this abduction, whatever it is, almost immediately being like, actually, Jack is not as, like, fun and sexy as I thought. He's kind of, like, maybe kind of a mess. And and you see Jack clearly is not comfortable ultimately. Maybe he's just, like, super drunk, but he's, like, getting tearful, and he's like, he helped me out of a really,
hole,
like, big hole, like a dark
deep
place.
Hole.
But he doesn't seem to the sort of manner born that Quentin does, which Quentin is very smooth in his deception thus far.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's been a little messy leaving that photo out and whatever, screwing with the door open.
Mm-hmm.
But like, Tanya and Quentin are so locked in these identities, as far as we understand Quentin's identity to be.
Yes.
And I found something dimly hopeful about the fact that their younger counterparts are actually like, I don't really like this. I don't feel comfortable. I want to change this.
They have, they have the capacity to change and the potential to change. I think that's so astute and so interesting. I think for me, it comes back to that scene with Portia and Tanya, and Tanya being like, I was a girl, I was a doll, and my parents dressed me up as a doll, and I was I was waiting for someone to play with me. Mm-hmm. And basically what happens at the end of the episode is she's dressed as a doll in a gorgeous little baby doll dress, and people are playing with her. Quentin is playing with her. She's like reenacting, even though she's giving advice to Portia, like, don't be like me, don't get your shit together. Tanya has not gotten her shit together at all. And she's replaying that cycle, albeit in a beautiful, fabulous, fun, you know, frivolous way. But she's still a doll and she's still getting played with. And she's getting played with by Quentin, who is absolutely a queer-coded Disney villain, like full Scar Jafar vibes. When he's smoking that cigarette, looking at Jack, sort of like, drive away in the distance. I'm like, okay, you're our gay villain.
When he walks into the room, the cocaine room, to introduce Tanya to her beau, mm-hmm. Tom Hollander does a good bit of he's close to camera, so he's not quite in focus, but he does this kind of sinister smile mm-hmm. to the guy, and it's like he can't even help himself. Like he's so pleased with
He's having fun. It's delicious, and I love it.
I guess the big question now, Chris, is, what is the scheme here? I mean, because the darkest scenario that I think mm-hmm. is maybe the most plausible is Greg is married to Tanya.
Yes.
If Tanya dies, doesn't he get the money?
Who gets the money?
She doesn't have children. Mm-hmm. She doesn't seem to have many other loved ones.
Her mom is dead. Her dad is dead. Yeah. Because her mom was the ashes from season one. Right. Her dad, you know, killed himself. And she mentions that. That's mentioned in this season. The money goes to Greg. And Greg, we learned through Jack, needs money, as we thought. And we did had our eye on the prize. Quentin needs money. And so if Quentin and Greg are in cahoots or in a relationship or, you know, and they split her fortune, you know, that could save the palazzo, that could save the boat, that could save Quentin's beautiful lifestyle.
And it's not just, I mean, we had a lot of people who write in saying, like, the house is rented. They don't even own it. You know, Quentin, like, and I'm just, how ruined is Quentin? Like, how, like, is it, like, I love when Tanya says, arancini cost a dollar.
That was, she says it cost
a dollar. And it's like,
okay,
so if they can't even afford that, but then Jack has the credit card, and it's like, maybe, but whose credit card is that? Is there some other old lady they scammed? You know, how bad is this? How dark does this go? And is it murderous?
Yeah, and I will say, that's also fair. And I think Portia, the final moments of the episode, realizing, oh shit, I got my adventure, but at what cost?
Right.
I am alone in a hotel room. This guy maybe is not related mm-hmm. to his uncle. This is scary. It was giving very Little Red in Into the Woods. Exciting and scared. And she messed with the wolf. And now she might get eaten by the big bad wolf. And the big bad wolf might be Jack plus Quentin. And also, going back to sort of the Portia Tanya theory of Portia Tanya and Greg, remember that Greg was so upset that Portia was on the trip. And he was like, he didn't know that Portia was coming. She has to go. She can't be here, mm-hmm. right? So maybe there's an element where, like, and now Tanya and Portia are separated. They're not together.
And Greg calls Quentin on the balcony when Tanya overhears, and he's like, we got a problem. Do you have something that could distract Portia? Do you have something that could take care of the Portia problem?
Yes.
And Quentin's like, oh, well, there's this guy from Love Island that I pay to have sex with. Maybe he would do a trick. And then what happens? Portia's sitting out by the pool. And who appears but Jack?
Out of the blue, a vision.
So this is all a long plan.
It's all a long plan, and right now I don't necessarily see how they get out of it. But the funny thing is that Jennifer Coolidge, Tanya, like, has basically all of the pieces. She has more information than any other person. She could put this together. She could solve it, but she's too busy being seduced by beauty and drugs and fun and alcohol and sex.
There is a line in the trailer for this season where we hear Tanya saying, was it all a scam? So I assume that's coming. She will have a moment where she confronts somebody about it. I kind of think that, like, Portia could... We'll get to the theories about who's dead and our final predictions for who's dead, by the way.
We're locking them in.
Later in the episode. But I don't know. I'm hoping that Mike White is also hopeful and lets Portia break the cycle, get away from this. Maybe even to the extent, and maybe it sounds cruel to Tanya, but Tanya hasn't been that nice to her.
Yeah.
Of, like, just leaving that hotel room that Jack is in and just, like, leaving, period.
Yeah.
And being like, I'm going to go. I thought I hated my boring life back home. I kind of don't, it turns out. The sort of excitement that I craved came freighted with danger.
Yes.
And also danger and like depressing shit. Like
yes.
Jack turns out to be really depressing.
He's really a really quite depressing character. And maybe she would have been better off with Albie. But Albie's in, you know, in the thick of it too.
Yeah.
He's got some shit going down with Lucia that I want to say. I know last week we talked about, like, is Alessio, is he for real? Is he not for real? Do you think Alessio is for real?
So we had some listeners write in saying, oh, I think Alessio is really her brother. He, in the first episode, we see her walk by him. It's no big deal.
I just rewatched that just to, like, make sure. And yeah, it's, like, literally fine.
Did Alessio really follow them all the way to this village from the hotel? Or did Lucia be like, hey, come around, you know, this time of day and scare us?
Yes, and I'm
you
sick
know?
Of translating, so, like,
how does this
take
work?
Me home.
I want to get into Alessio, but first I have to say, a new queen has entered the chat, and
Ooh.
She's holding an artichoke.
She is mother. She's literally, she's mother.
Yeah, yeah. She is so good. Poor Bert just wanted to meet some DeGrassos and Degrassi. I guess that would be the plural.
Mm-hmm, Degrassi.
Yeah, they have a great high school in Toronto.
No Drake.
yeah. What did you make of that whole scene? Because what was the sort of energy there? Was it just that, like, they're suspicious of outsiders, or was there more at play?
I think there was more. One, life imitates art, and I love that. Or art imitates life, who's to say? Two, I think there's a pretty compelling narrative or question to dive into, in that, like, Bert was only thinking about himself. The DeGrassos were only thinking about themselves.
Yeah.
They wanted the homecoming. They wanted their family reunion just for them. Three random men show up to my house speaking a language that I don't know, trying to, like, hang out. Like, it's so somewhat like American narcissism, where, like, of course, like, it's, you know, the fantasy is going to work out.
It's
and
intrusive.
It's intrusive. They're being intrusive, and they're gawking. It's also a little bit poverty tourism, where it's like, they're, you know.
Let's meet the earthy people who are related to us.
Yes.
And, yeah. Yeah. And this was kind of predicted by a listener who wrote in a weeks ago saying, my prediction for that storyline is that they're going to have what a lot of Italian Americans experience when they come to Sicily trying to trace their roots, which is like, oh, Sicily's kind of a rough place and it's a poor place. And I think that prediction proved mostly true. Although that house was not, you know, some hovel.
No.
And I thought that there was something interesting about how that reflected how Bert considers his past with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Dominic has a very different memory of that marriage. Bert puts gloss on things. He remembers things with through rose-colored glasses. He thinks that life is some sort of grand narrative that he's moving through.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then he cries at the dinner table because he's like, wait, I don't really have, like, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Okay.
You always think there's going to be a homecoming. The embrace of a woman. It tells you you've done all right.
Well, there is no homecoming.
Not for me. Not anymore.
He's not Portia's age or Albie's age. He's sort of further on in his life. Like, there was an age aspect in terms of the passage of time and how he'll never get that fantasy back.
He can wistfully drink a martini and listen to this beautiful young woman sing and tell her he's a fan. And like, maybe what he has is sort of some fading charm, and there's not a bigger story of his life that he had kind of concocted for himself, which is, you know, if that's I don't think it's the end of Bert's storyline, but like, if that's one of the bigger conclusions, like, I think we'd been wondering throughout this season, like, what are Dominic and Bert really doing in this story? Like, how are they functioning in it? But I think Mike White might be arriving at just some poignant conclusions that are untethered to who's dead. And I mean, we did get some listener theories that Bert's dead because he has a head injury and maybe he goes swimming or something, which could still happen.
Totally.
But I think that in order to balance out narratively all of the sexual, romantic, perhaps murderous intrigue happening in other storylines that Albie's maybe loosely connected to, we needed also some stuff that was more human scale. And I mean, not that the other stuff isn't human scale, but you know what I mean? Like, more sort of soft.
Yes.
And sad. So I guess the question with that, with their storyline, is for you, how much danger do you think they're in?
To me, and I still feel like Alessio might not be who she says Alessio.
Because we saw her wheels turning a couple episodes ago where she's talking with Mia and she's like, kind of intimated, I have a new plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan seems to be she does like Albie.
She does.
And she knows he really likes her. I think it's important that the episode opened with them in bed again.
Yes, yes. It's still hot and
briefly.
Heavy.
And she's like, I'm going to get this guy. My brother Alessio is going to help us out, or whoever he is,
yeah,
my friend.
My cousin.
And who they conveniently run into
yeah.
all the time.
All the time.
She could have just texted and be like, hey, we're going to go on an ice cream date. Just be on the street.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And then grab my arm and that's...
And you know... He'll chase Alessio, will chase her into his arms, and he'll whisk her off to America. And in some ways, wouldn't that reflect Bert's fascination with the Godfather and,
yes.
and Americans in Sicily, like the wife that Al Pacino is supposed to marry and then gets blown up? Like this fantasy of the World War II war bride.
Yeah.
You know, like kind of like Bridges of Madison County. Like, you know, Albie might be fulfilling some sort of family fantasy about their Italian roots. To bring a troubled Italian girl home.
Yeah.
And I think that Lucia knows that though that she's probably slept with a lot of Americans. She knows that they have that sort of tropey fantasy mm-hmm. in their heads, and she's maybe appealing to it. There's a little danger, a little excitement, a lot of sexiness.
Yeah.
And it's working.
Wow, that's so funny, because when I was watching the episode, the movie that I went to for Albie and Lucia was Little Shop of Horrors. I was like, oh, she's Audrey, and he's
uh-huh.
Seymour. And then Alessio is the dentist or some, you know, and that's
right,
their
right.
dynamic and whatnot. But I do think I want to give Lucia the agency that you just gave, in that, like, she's quite smart and she's quite cunning. So concocting, I totally think it's within her wheelhouse to concoct this sort of grand plan to get, you know, if not Albie to take her all the way back to Los Angeles, to get like a shit ton of money out of this rich family,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, because she wasn't born yesterday. So I, with Mike White, it's never necessarily as simple as it seems. And I feel like Alessio, her actually being in danger with Alessio would be perhaps too simple.
Yes, I agree with that. I almost foresee, I mean, a lot of my predictions have been wrong for this show, but I foresee a sort of end of the graduate moment with Albie and Lucia on the plane home.
Mm.
And Albie being like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
I don't know. Again, we'll get to the death predictions, but like, I feel like Lucia might be in a better position than I thought.
Yeah.
Who I'm wondering about, partly because I talked to our colleague David Friend, who is an old, very venerable Vanity Fair staffer of many years.
Absolutely.
And he has an interesting theory about maybe one of the dead people, which is that, remember when Mia poisoned someone and almost killed him?
Yeah, that was pretty
and he didn't
wild.
Die? And she didn't. She did it by accident, sort of. But
yeah.
like, what if he comes back? Is Mia in trouble? I mean, she has
yeah.
this thing going with Valentina. We know that, based on season one, that chances are people of the lower socioeconomic stations are mm-hmm. most peril.
Vulnerable.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, like, maybe we've been focusing on Lucia and all this Alessio stuff, but maybe we kind of forgot about Mia in there.
Oh, well, that would be so sad, because I mean, in a pretty bleak, intense. I mean, the episode was really fun, so I take that back. It was a really fun episode, but one of the most fun parts of it was Mia and Valentina's sort of like, you know, fun, sexy night together. So I'd be really sad to see Mia go, but yeah.
She's to go back to the Survivor stuff that Mike White likes. I think Mia's maybe playing too hard. She kind of took the baton from Lucia,
yeah,
and was like, I'm gonna fuck the piano player. And then, oh, but I need to give him unknown drugs at the same
yeah.
time.
And
now I'm going to screw
Valentina.
Yeah, because she's sad on her birthday. And like, and I don't know what Mia, I think Mia, you know, she's like a likable character in a way. But like, I kind of think with what she does with Valentina is cruel.
Okay.
It's condescending in a way.
Well, I do agree. And her response when Valentina admits that she's never been with a woman
right.
was like, even I've been with a woman. That was like,
that was hurtful.
That was very condescending. Yeah. And, I can see that. Although, in a way, you could look at it as a condescending, but you could also look at the, you know, her hooking up with Valentina as a gift, in a way, for on her birthday. I
yeah.
think there's, like, that's another side of that coin, is giving this woman the gift yeah. of pleasure that she's never experienced
It's
before.
Complicated. And maybe the sex doesn't have to be a big deal. Maybe it's just that. I mean, I feel like for Valentina, who... you know, she's an interesting character in the season. She's not as major as Armand was,
yeah.
so she's been kind of in the side, you know, the peripheral, but like, again, we know she's alive.
Yes, we do know.
I feel like Valentina's going to have a big final episode.
Yeah. Well, I think perhaps her set piece and, you know, one of my favorite scenes of this episode, which broke my heart, was when Isabella is like, oh, by the way, I'm engaged to Rocco. And Valentina thinks that they're about to go on like a little drink date on her birthday.
Well, it gets progressively worse.
To the point where she's literally holding back tears. Though that lip tremble that Sabrina Impacciatore, the actress who plays Valentina, her trembling lip after Isabella walks away, that is called acting. Mm-hmm. That is acting. Mm-hmm. That is, mm-hmm. It was incredible. It was so moving. I would like my Italian girlies to make it to the end. I'm pulling for Lucia. I'm pulling for Mia. I'm pulling for Valentina. Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with Aubrey Plaza and our final theories about who's dead.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Well, let's turn to the last kind of, you know, part of the triptych of this episode, which is our two couples. You know, when I weeks ago when I interviewed Will Sharp about Ethan, and he hadn't really done much. This was for the first episode, and Will Sharp did sort of intimate that like more was coming for that character, and it was a slow build.
Yeah,
but in this episode, we see, I think, oh boy. Ethan really has not gotten over any of this stuff from his youth, from high school, from college, in particular with Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
And like, maybe is about to burst into nerd rage, which is, as we know from living in this country, one of the scariest kinds of rage.
Yes, one of the scariest, absolutely, very, and that can be very violent and can mean very bad things for a lot of people. I have to ask you, because I gotta know. Do you think Harper and Cameron did it behind his back?
I thought it was really well done how it left it. I mean, obviously, later we see Ethan kind of imagine how it went, and you're like, that's entirely credible.
Yes.
It weirdly is also entirely credible that nothing happened.
Yes. It's like, if I did it, here's how I would do it.
And I don't know, because I don't quite know. I don't know. It's hard to say, because I feel like we know Harper, but and part of me is like, I don't think she would go that far, because would she really want to screw over Daphne that much? But would Daphne even really care that much? You know,
that's how I felt at the beginning, but I do think this episode and sort of the scene work that Aubrey Plaza did, specifically the first scene, really laid the groundwork for Harper doing it. They have that really intense conversation in the morning where Harper basically says, I'm not attracted to you anymore.
I mean, we're not honest about...
About what?
About how we're not attracted to each other anymore. Or at least you're not attracted to me. It's like, I get it. You're on top of the world right now. You can sleep with whoever you want, and
stop
you're stuck with me.
That stuff.
Yeah, it makes sense that you'd want to have sex with an Italian hooker. You're not
getting
any.
I didn't have sex with an Italian hooker. Jesus fuck.
I'm just saying that it's not the cheating
that
bothers me.
There was no cheating.
So
there was no cheating.
As what it says about us.
What? What does it say?
That maybe something has died. We are too young to be this old, Ethan. I'm sure you don't want that part of your life to be over, do you?
Chris, you went in search of more insight about Harper, and you went to the source. You talked to Aubrey Plaza.
I did. I talked to Aubrey Plaza, and we chatted about whether Harper and Cameron did the deed, and we talked about her Gotham Award-nominated performance in Emily the Criminal.
Let's hear that now.
Thank you so, so much for taking time out of your crazy schedule
thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Aubrey, I've got to say, I am so unbelievably impressed by the work that you're doing on this show. It's so fantastic and complicated and nuanced and kind of terrifying in a way, in the best possible way. Because Harper, when we get to episode 6, Harper sort of has nothing to lose anymore.
That's the thing is, I don't know how it's put together, but I don't know. It's in the fifth episode, she's kind of confronted with what she thinks is the truth.
Yeah.
Right, of what happened. But I think these kinds of things, when these kinds of things happen in relationships, that's never really about that, you know? Mm-hmm. It's always about something bigger. There's always macro issues that are really the issue, and then these little things that happen in relationships they kind of just spark the larger stuff. So
totally.
I think maybe 6 is kind of the first time that you get to hear what's really going on with these two people, you know, because mm-hmm. you wonder the whole time why are they not having sex,
yeah.
you know, what is going on. But it's so it's kind of the first time that they really have it out, right?
Yeah, no, they really do. And Harper's we haven't had sex in so long. And I didn't even, from watching it, I didn't even think about how their sexual issues probably extend way beyond the White Lotus, in their, you know, backstories for their character, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, for me, that was important, that when they show up on the boat, that they're not in a good place, you know, because I think that that's how the stakes become higher for
yeah.
me anyways, if you treat it like that, if it's it's not just a bad vacation, you know, it's a bad time in their marriage and they just happen to be going to the most beautiful place on a beautiful vacation, but they're just not in a good place. And that's the thing. It's like that old Adam Sandler SNL sketch that he did in the 80s or 90s or whatever, where it's Rome is beautiful, but if you're sad at your house, you're going to be sad in Rome too, or whatever.
Yeah.
That sketch. But so it's
totally.
It's about that. But yes, this 6th episode is gnarly because there's some truth, you know, the truth's being told, I guess. And they're saying some stuff that they probably have never said to each other before. That was excruciating.
Wow. Some of those truths, though, that are said, particularly between Harper and Ethan, when she says wanting and loving are two different things, maybe something has died between us. It feels like you can't really come back from that. I don't know. Do you think their relationship is kaput, or do you think they can work on it, like Ethan says?
I think you can always work on it. It's a choice. You know, there's no right or wrong. I think that's the thing that's so scary about marriage is it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And if you decide to do the work, then you go on.
And that's so applicable to Harper and Ethan. But then it gets more complicated because you have this wild card external factor of Cameron being, you know, so disgusting and grotesque, but also so magnetic and handsome. And clearly there's or at least my interpretation of Harper and Cameron's relationship is that Harper's kind of disgusted by him, but she's also kind of into him, right? And that's going to make it sort of difficult for her and Ethan. Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think he represents kind of the other side, you know. He represents the like kind of uninhibited, unapologetically, I don't know, free earth side of things. And I think, I don't know, I don't think Harper's actually attracted to him. I think she's disgusted by him. But I think that, well, yeah, I mean, I think that, I think that just in terms of her personality, like, I just don't, I just can't, I don't think he's her type, you know. I just think that, but I think that, I think he's hitting on a nerve with her, which is that she, you know, wants to box, you know, she wants, sorry, but she just, no, it's like,
don't apologize. Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like, we're animals, you know?
Oh, 100%. Harper, also, it's like, Harper, given the vacation that they've had, you know, she leaves for one night, she goes to Noto, and Ethan, you know, has hookers over and does Molly. Would she be so wrong to have sex with Cameron, like, after the vacation they've had?
I mean, sex? I don't know about that. But
that's fair.
I don't know. I mean, that's the whole thing about this show, and that's the whole thing about Mike White's writing, is just that there is no wrong. There is no right. It's like the gray area, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, nobody's better than the other person. We all have flaws. We all make mistakes. And it's, that's what's interesting about it. Is it wrong for her to kind of do, act out, you know, and do something? Or is it fair? Or, and was what he did wrong? You know, I have my own opinions about it. I was pissed.
You were pissed? Tell me about that.
Well, I don't know. I think, like I was saying before, in the grander scheme of things, I was pissed as Harper because I felt that it was unfair almost. Why is it so, you know, easy for him to go do something crazy like that or whatever with these people that he barely even likes and to not show that side of himself to me or something, where it's like, and it's like, yes, I guess technically he didn't cheat on her, I guess, but I don't know. I mean, doing Molly with prostitutes in your room and being there while your friend's having sex with a prostitute, I don't know. I'm old fashioned, I guess, but to me, that fucking sucks.
I think that
I'd
we can agree. That
I'd
fucking
be really
sucks.
Pissed. I think of these, you know, these prostitute characters as friends because I know them because I love them to death, Simona and Beatrice. I know them as, so I it's like, I don't want to talk bad about their characters, but she doesn't know these people. These are prostitutes in another country. I mean, it's like, you could get a fucking disease, you know, you're going to bring that home with you. Like, who are you? I think it's more of the who are you kind of thing that's upsetting than the, like, you know, in, you know, new whatever than the actual act of whatever he did. It's more just like, what is happening? Her whole world has turned upside down. She's like, what's going on?
And I love what you mentioned too about Mia and Lucia and sort of, and how you as an actress, like, you're, you know, you're friends with Beatrice and Simona and whatnot, but like in the course of the show, you've never seen these women before. And then you see Ethan talking to Mia and Lucia and you accuse him of gaslighting, and like, but also are you gaslighting him too with the Cameron stuff? It's sort of like, it's complicated.
That moment. Yeah. That moment when it's like, they've already had it out and she already is basically like, ugh, it's fine. I'm over it. It's not about that anymore.
Yeah.
It's about this other stuff. And then she goes down and sees him argue with these prostitutes. She's like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, what is that?
What is that?
I mean,
you say gaslighting, you say, I mean, that's like a pretty definition, and people misuse that word all the time. But I was like, Harper is actually 100% correct in her use of the word gaslighting.
Yeah. What a scary word.
Just with that word, it's like so heated and it's so like, you know, it's people get so intense about it. Like when you saw that in the script, were you like, did that trigger anything, or were you like, oh, we're going
for sure? I remember very clearly reading that line when I read the script, are you gaslighting me? And it was just like, ugh, like a knife to the gut kind of line.
It sucks, but it's so delicious to watch. I gotta say, if you want to watch, it's really really fantastic.
I see it as, it's almost like hard for me to, because I read them all the scripts, and I see it as like a movie, almost like a wow. like a long, like 7-hour movie or something. So I don't want to be distracted, so I'm going to hold out. And then
I love it. Oh, well, you're in for an absolute treat. And wait, and speaking of treats, I want to transition and talk about your phenomenal performance, your Gotham Award nominated performance in Emily the Criminal,
which is
sort of completely like, in terms of going from the White Lotus, we're sort of going to a completely different socioeconomic situation, a totally different world. Can you tell me a little bit about, like, you know, filming both or transitioning from one to the other and what that was like? Because Emily, you know, she's down and out. She's got debts. She's got money problems.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, so Emily the Criminal, I shot in the summer, and then I had like a couple months off, and then I did White Lotus. So they weren't like back to back or anything like that, which definitely would have been weird, because they're so different. And you know, we shot Emily the Criminal in Los Angeles. It's like a very kind of gritty, like LA story, but like the LA that people don't normally show in films, or at least anyways nowadays. I feel like they used to make a lot of movies in the 70s and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
LA crime stories and stuff like that. But yeah, they're totally different. Emily is, yeah, she's definitely not a lawyer that just came into $1 billion. She's not going on any fancy trips to Sicily. She's working in the gig economy. She's a caterer, you know, delivery person, and she's got a record. She's got a criminal record, and she's from Jersey, and she's trying to kind of make it, you know, in this city, in this like unknown foreign city of Los Angeles, which is a really hard town to be a fish out of water and to have no resources, you know, and to have everything stacked against you. It's a hard town to survive in. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. And then a lot of people can relate to just having so much debt, you know, she's got this little debt problem, student loans problem, and no help. So it's kind of, she's kind of got everything working against her. And the movie is, what I do think is interesting though, just comparing both of the things is,
because
I realized this yesterday, is like, for me, both of White Lotus and Emily the Criminal, they both start with the character being at an 11, like, and kind of already being in a really shitty place. Whereas like a lot of times characters start in like a normal neutral place, and then you see them get to the bad place, and then you see them get overcome it. But for both these things, for me, it was important that the characters are already like, they're already fucked. Like
they're
Emily, like in the very beginning, Emily's got this interview scene, and you can tell it. She's just like, she's had enough. She's like, she flips out, and it's like, you're like, okay, well, if that's where she's at now, then where is this going to go?
Truly. It's so interesting because they're both, you know, they're different characters, but they both, Harper and Emily, they both hate being lied to. That seems like such a big trigger, honesty and the truth. I mean, that first scene in Emily the Criminal where, you know, the employer, the job interview, he lies to her face and then she freaks out. I found that such an interesting thread to me in terms of like hating to be lied to.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never think about it like that. I mean, I think maybe they're both really kind of authentic characters. They're like, they're flawed characters, and they can't help, you know, be who they are. It's like, I like people like that. People that are just kind of like, you know, just take me as I am. Like, I'm just, you know, it's like,
because
Harper is like that. It's like, she can't, she's a lawyer. She's critiquing every situation. She's evaluating things and analyzing things, and that's just her personality. And sometimes she comes off like a bitch, but it's like, she's not, she's just, that's just, you know, who she is. And then Emily is like, she's just no bullshit, you know. She's like, I've been in jail, like, I don't give a shit, like, you know what I mean? Like,
I was thinking Emily really could have used Harper's services for her day job in terms of when the guy is like,
I know,
you know,
these two characters could really help each other out.
Got to get them in the same room. Oh, wow. Well, Aubrey, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to chat with me. Your work is absolutely phenomenal. I can't wait. I'm rooting for Harper for the end, for the last episode. I'm rooting for her.
Oh my God, I'm so scared.
Oh. Well, I guess then we should get into our final bit of theorizing. But I want to, before you and I make our big final predictions, that, you know, we stand to win a drink here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is serious business.
The stakes couldn't be higher.
Pete wrote into us with an interesting subject line, which was White Lotus and location of the deceased.
Mm.
He writes, I rewatched the beginning of episode one. Rocco tells Valentina one of the guests has drowned and that, quote, Salvatore says other bodies have been found. He does not say where the other bodies were found, but I'd assume he would not say one has drowned if multiple people were in the sea. Mm-hmm. So only one body is shown being taken by authorities on the beach. Okay, Pete, great observation.
Thank you, Pete.
We should have probably paid more attention to that verbiage on the first episode. So that does complicate things. It might not be four bodies in the water. It could be one in the water and then people elsewhere.
And one in a hotel room or, you know.
Right. Or on that little island that they pointed to, that Quentin pointed out, where the Swedish dowager was found, you know, thrown off the cliff or whatever. So yeah. I feel like my tendency is to throw it to you because then that way I have more time to think. But I'm going to give you more time to think.
Oh, thank you. I need it.
Maybe we should, well, to give ourselves both more time to think, just give a little refresh very briefly of predictions you and I have made in the past.
Yeah. And we can even vote on if they're still viable or not.
Yeah, maybe that's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do it make any sense anymore?
So week one, you predicted Tanya and I said Mia and Lucia. I think maybe Mia.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be Tanya anymore.
I don't either. I also think they announced a third season. It's been renewed. I don't know if you get rid of Cool.
Yeah.
Although, what is she going to have left to do? We'll see.
That's
Week two, you said Harper, Chris, and I said Portia and Albie in some sort of he attempts to save her from drowning or something. I think
now
that
that's so
ship
funny.
Has very much sailed.
Yeah, that ship has sailed. Harper, I do think, still has legs, or Ethan, even, too. So I do think that's still fair.
Week three, you said Portia. I said Cameron. I don't remember saying that. And also, again, me and Lucia. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Again, I think Portia. I think she's gonna get out.
I'm
wrong.
I think she's gonna get out too. She's not my final. She's not my final girl for this in terms of who I'm gonna lock in, who I think is gonna not make it.
Yeah.
So I think she's gonna be okay.
Week four. You predicted Harper goes on a murderous rampage. I said Quentin, I don't think the death is a villain death.
Okay. You don't think it's at the Palazzo. You don't think it's.
Well, I'm building a theory about the based on Pete's email.
Okay.
Multiple locations for bodies.
Ooh, okay.
Finally, week five, episode five. You suggest Ethan kills Cameron, which feels entirely possible at this point. And I predicted, as did our colleague David Friend, that there is another jet ski incident and they crash into each other and one of them winds up dead. Okay. So that's where we left things. Final predictions. I'll go first, as I said.
Okay. Please do, because I really don't know where my head's at right now.
There are multiple locations of dead bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of them is Bert, who like dies in his hotel room.
Okay.
He falls. Yeah.
Swan song, good night. Okay.
I think, obviously, someone's dead in the water. Maybe that could be Bert. Maybe he goes for a swim.
Yeah.
But my hunch is Ethan.
Okay. Ethan,
in some sort of struggle.
Okay. Ethan in a struggle.
Yeah. And then I don't want to say this because it sounds dark.
Hey, go there. You can go there. Go there.
I think Valentina accidentally kills Mia.
Oh my God. Do you have a theory of how that might happen or how that?
I think maybe Valentina gets really attached after just one night and in like some sort of rage, like hits her over the head with one of those head statues.
With one of those head statues.
Yeah.
Wow, Richard, that is a really, really, really good theory.
I mean, that's so mean to Valentina, but
that is. But it's it's given the first season, it's Murray Bartlett. The killee becomes the killer
right.
in terms of the manager of the
yeah.
Similarly, okay, I also am going to do sort of a multi-pronged final theory because I think too much is happening in the Palazzo with Tanya and Portia and Jack and Quentin for somebody not to wind up dead in that scenario. I don't think it's Jennifer Coolidge. I don't think it's
But they'd Tanya. Have to get back to the hotel.
Yeah.
For something to happen.
They would have to get back to the hotel. And we've been dangling that Greg is supposed to return to too.
Right.
Right?
Maybe it's Greg.
So maybe it's Greg. So I'm going to say that they go back to the hotel. Greg is there. And I think something happens and Greg winds up dead. Jennifer Coolidge has a gun now. Like, it's like there's like...
Chekhov's gun.
Chekhov's gun. You know, it she's got to use it. So I think it's Greg. I think she might, you know, shoot Greg in a murderous rage or, you know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, maybe she wouldn't make it to season three, but we'll see. So that's part one. I definitely believe that somebody of the foursome, one of the foursome, at least one of the foursome is dead.
Yeah.
It's the only way that makes sense. I do think Ethan hulking out and going ballistic, Bree, Cameron, and Harper potentially having sex makes the most sense. But I'm not going to go with my head. I'm going to go with my heart. And my heart is saying that Daphne is the killer. Daphne kills somebody and Daphne is somehow behind it in some way. She didn't do enough in this last episode. She was so not there that I feel like she's bound to do something really crazy in the have a big final episode. So I think that maybe Daphne somehow either kills Harper or Cameron. I'm thinking of Cameron, because guess what? He's probably not even the father of her kids.
Right.
So, and he's, you know, having sex with other people and doing all these things, and is a terrible, terrible guy just to begin with.
Yeah.
That I think there'd be a lot of satisfaction. I don't know. Maybe that's what my heart wants, is for Daphne to kill Cameron. Maybe it doesn't make a lick of sense, but I think it's Cameron. Yeah, so I think Greg's dead. I think Cameron's dead. And I'll say Harper too. I think it's Cameron and Harper. That's what I'm going with. I don't think any of the DeGrasse.
I like your theories. Let's say Greg's the one in the water.
Okay.
He gets pushed off the boat by Tanya or something.
Something like that.
The yacht is coming back with Quentin and everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. She finds out it's a scam. He dies. Daphne kills people in one of the rooms.
Daphne kills people in one of the rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the door with the head statue and the door being open and closed.
The door. That's right. The door.
It's too many set pieces that haven't been fully used yet that I feel.
And Ethan looks at that head statue again in this episode, or someone does.
No, it's definitely Ethan. Yeah. Ethan looks at it.
Yeah.
So I know.
And that's about a woman killing a guy.
It's about a woman killing a guy for cheating. Which is what happened with Daphne. So yeah, I'm going. I'm with my girl Daphne for this one.
Have we not been reading obvious signs this whole season?
Are we even smart?
I don't Well, based on the listener emails, they are picking up on a lot of stuff that we, the professional recappers, are not. So we'd love to hear your final theories as well. You can email us again at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. It doesn't have to be about a theory about who's dead. It could be, you know, kind of summative thoughts on the show before the final episode airs. Yeah, and then we'll be back for one more week. And again, one of us is going to... I guess we'll have to figure out how we judge who got closest to being right. But
We're going to have to... We'll have to go to the judges for that.
Why don't we introduce a new rule to the contest? If someone is killed with one of those head statues, we both win.
Yes. Okay.
Because we predicted that.
Yes, because we did predict that. So that's actually literally fair. Oh, my gosh. I really hope I win.
Before we close out, I just want to make one little housekeeping note. We are not going to get a screener in advance for the finale episode, so we will be recording probably after the show airs for everyone.
Watching it live for the first time.
So the podcast will drop a little bit late, but maybe we'll make it it worth your wait.
It'll be worth the wait. Yeah. Don't worry.
In the meantime, you can, again, email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You can find us individually on Twitter. I'm at RILAWS, Rylaws, Chris.
And I'm at Christress, CHRISTRESS.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our editor and producer is Dave Gonzalez, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes and Katie Rick. Our engineer is Kevin Barassa. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next week for the finale of The White Lotus Season 2. Until then.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.